Hello, this is Daniel Jalka.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition. I think you're wrong, for the record. This episode is brought to you by Text Expander for Teams and Linode.
Well, Daniel, last week we talked about the education event, tried to kind of figure out what Apple was thinking with the event, went through some of the announcements. Bottom line is they really care about teachers, classrooms, schools, kids. They wanted a story around that, but it's a new week, and now the story is pro users.
Pros.
They care about pro users, too. But unlike an event, they invite people from all over the world, all over the country to go to in a beautiful auditorium, hundreds of people.
Mm-hmm.
This time, smaller group. Matthew Panzerino of TechCrunch just published an article as we're recording about being invited to the Apple campus for them to tell him about the Mac Pro. It's really happening. It's a thing. But it's going to be 2019.
And John Siracusa wept. You know, this is interesting because I remember, and Matthew alludes to this, doesn't just allude to it. He says, you know, like they talked last year about the expectation for when it would ship. And there was like some kind of specific clarification when somebody said, oh, yeah, so it's shipping in 2018, right? And they were like, we didn't say that. We just said it's not shipping. Yeah.
Well, maybe not.
2017. Yeah. So I think there was already at least built in some curtailed expectations. But I'm sure people who are really excited about the Mac Pro have also been just, you know, holding out some hope that it was still coming this year. And, you know, there was two interpretations. Like, that meant, hey, we don't want to paint ourselves into a corner. We're planning on getting it out in 2018, but we're not going to say that publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And the other interpretation, of course, is, oh, we have so much to do. We just know this isn't going to be done until 2019.
I think it's the latter. I think they probably knew it was going to be 2019. And they called that event because they wanted to tell people, don't buy the current Mac Pro. If you want something, the iMac Pro is going to be your thing. We're really excited about it. Don't wait around.
Yeah.
And a lot of people took that advice and they bought the iMac Pro and they've been happy with it for months now. And they can continue to use that for a whole nother year. Mm-hmm. Before deciding whether to get the Mac Pro. If Apple had never done the event or they had said, oh yeah, early 2018 is our goal or something like that, people might have waited and then they would be, you know, even further behind.
Right. And there's another aspect to that, which is people, to the extent that Apple actually does take a while to get this 2019 Mac Pro out, at least it alleviates some of the like, oh, should have waited, you know, mm-hmm. feeling that people will have if, you know, Apple said like, hey, everybody, just so you know, this is going to be a while. So you might want to buy that Mac Pro, iMac Pro, I mean.
Right.
And then 3 months later, and here's the Mac Pro.
Exactly.
Be like, what the heck? Like, they did something with that several years ago with one of the iPhones, didn't they? Like, they came out with an iPhone. Was it the first iPhone? I'm vaguely remembering now. I have to look this up. I remember some people were miffed because Apple sold an iPhone to a bunch of people and then like months later upped some spec about it. And it might have been like the memory or something. I don't remember. I have to look it up.
Don't remember that.
But I remember people being miffed about it. And it was like, dude, you got the first iPhone or whatever it was. I don't remember what it was.
Oh, well, there was the whole thing where they gave people $200. They dropped the price. Like,
oh, that's it. That's exactly what I'm trying to remember.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little different, but.
But you're right. It's like, yeah, you've had this cutting edge from the future device for months, so don't complain. And
right.
I think that was a fine kind of compromise. And it turned out, I mean, I don't think that blew up in Apple's face as any kind of major PR problem that I can remember.
Yeah, so I think the interesting thing that this 2019 confirmation, the most interesting thing about that aspect of this article, so there's a couple things in this article I think we should talk about. The pure like hardware estimate update, I think the most interesting thing about that is probably speculating about just what is it they could be doing that could take so long to get right.
Right.
You know, like kind of begs my imagination, similarly to like your scrutiny of the Apple Classroom, or was it the Classroom or the work?
Schoolwork.
Schoolwork.
Classroom.
Yeah, whatever it was that is coming for the Mac in beta
that's
at
classroom.
WWDC. Oh, that's Classroom.
Yeah.
Yeah. So similar to how you sort of read between the lines, I think correctly to imagine that there's some technical sort of like, there's some kind of technical timeline thing. It's not like they can't make the software ready to ship beta today. It's that they want to time it with something else later is basically the baseline, the basis of your scrutiny. And, you know, you suggested that it's maybe because they're tying it to this new Marzipan, whatever. And delays like this, because like they announced this a year ago, right? The Mac Pro. Yeah, it was a year ago. to hear now, a year later, that it's going to be another year, effectively. It doesn't sound like somebody talking about a project that was already substantially underway a year ago.
No, they probably had a lot to figure out still. Maybe they had some prototypes, maybe not. I mean, it seemed like they weren't sure exactly what they were going to do. They just knew they wanted something for pro users. They wanted it modular, whatever that means, upgradable. And unfortunately, they're in a weird position now. It's like the longer you wait delivering something, and this is not just Apple, this is us, this is everybody. The longer you wait, the more pressure there is to deliver something substantial. And I feel this like this just in, I mean, in my apps, in like client work or something like that, like, oh, it's late, but I promise it's going to be great. And then like, no, it really, now it really needs to be great. Like when I right, show off right. what I'm working on. And I feel like that's happening with this is they've got some idea for the Mac Pro. Who knows what it is? It's going to have to be amazing or people are not going to understand the multi-year delay getting it out.
Yeah, I mean, if they just come out with like, well, we figured out the thermals on that trash can.
Yeah.
Mac Pro. And it's only taking us 6 years.
Or if it's just like a boring gray box that you can put extra drives in. Like some people would love that, but it doesn't justify a 2 year delay, right? It's just boring computer.
That's why that's so interesting. And I think there are some like obvious reasonings for that that jump to mind, kind of like along the lines of what you said with the Marzipan thing. On the hardware front, there's this kind of parallel rumor that Apple, well, there's not just, it's a rumor based on an article from Bloomberg claiming that there's, you know, that there's like, they have a source that suggests it's, you know, credible that Apple's actually planning to switch its Macs to a proprietary chipset. And there's been these rumors about Apple going to ARM architecture for Macs for years and years and years. And it's always been kind of like, well, there's, I don't know if they can make them powerful enough, la-di-da-di-da. If you imagine Apple has been on this thrust, and you imagine that one of the things that they've needed to do is figure out how to make their ARM chips, like, you know, whatever the desktop version of like the A8, 9, whatever chips are, make it powerful enough to be a desktop. Boy, if you could make it powerful enough to power a Mac Pro, you'd be in business.
Right. It really is fascinating, like, what they have planned. Is this all tied together or not? And in the CoreIntuition Slack this morning, there were a couple comments about this and questions. Coco Samurai, Colin Wheeler, in the chat, he talked about, like, when you think about the PowerPC to Intel transition, he said, a need was felt by customers who couldn't buy PowerBook G5s and Apple cited performance per watt as the need to move forward. They had to do Intel, right? So what is the deal now? It's not so obvious. I'm paraphrasing now. This isn't a quote from him, but it's not so obvious like what the consumer need is, why they have to do this. And is it tied up with the Mac Pro or not? The Bloomberg article mentioned 2020 as when they could possibly start moving away from Intel. Now we know the Mac Pro is 2019 for sure. So those don't seem to line up.
Yeah, I appreciate Colin's question. I guess I don't think of Apple as needing to have as sort of like clear cut of a connection between consumer demand and hardware architectural choices as the question, if I'm reading it right, sort of suggests. It seems to me like we've had over the course of Apple's history, architectural changes, big and small, that sometimes do seem really tied to sort of like being stuck and needing a way forward, and sometimes just seem sort of like the natural progression of things. And, you know, you think of things like going from, I mean, I guess you could argue there's a user demand behind a lot of these things, but like going from 24-bit architectures on the Mac to 32-bit at a time was like something that developers had to accommodate. And I guess it was, you know, it was at the end of the day, it was to accommodate, you know, users wanting more RAM. But I, you know, other transitions like 68K to PowerPC and then PowerPC to Intel, you know, sometimes they sort of solved problems on the way, but I guess I'm not enough of an expert about that to know whether how much of that was just also kind of like Apple wanted a different architecture for strategic reasons, you know?
Well, like with the PowerPC to Intel, it was, they felt like they were being held back.
Yeah.
You know, specific, like with notebooks, but also with desktops, and just like, they felt like they couldn't, they were stuck. They couldn't go further without moving to Intel. And I really do think they had to make that change. And what's really interesting about that transition is, so I was at WWDC that year in the keynote. And a couple of days before the keynote, Apple had leaked that this might happen. And we didn't know it was Apple, but there was like a Wall Street Journal or some, you know, some post that's like, Apple's thinking about doing Intel. I'm like, well, that's weird. Some weird, crazy rumor. And then Steve Jobs says, it's true. We're doing it. And I remember that feeling in the audience, like everyone looking at each other like, what is happening? Because it was unbelievable at the time. Like you would never have thought Apple would do that after spending years and years on stage talking about how great PowerPC was compared to Intel and doing speed tests and all this sort of thing. And I remember being shocked. Now it's different. No one's going to be shocked. It's almost like it's inevitable. It's almost like it might happen just because everyone thinks it will, even if there's not a really great reason to do it.
Yeah. Well, so I think there's lots of great reasons to do it that even if they're not driven specifically by customer demand, they might have customer payout down the road. And I think the iPhone iOS line of devices is a perfect example for that. You could have imagined Apple sticking with, you know, commodity chips for all of their iOS devices. It would have been reasonable, I think, to make the same argument that there's no consumer demand for this transition. Now, granted, the architecture is the same, so it's not there wasn't like a developer impact on that. I could see there being a lot of payoff for Apple and then indirectly for users down the road if Apple can make the same kinds of technical advances with custom chips on the Mac as they have made on iOS devices, then it's one of those situations where customers aren't asking for it, but they'll be grateful when they get it, I think.
I mean, I could see that. I think I'm coming from it just with the, oh my gosh, no more disruptions to my workflow right now. Because even though this transition would be many, many times easier than 68K to PowerPC or PowerPC to Intel, you know, for most people, they recompile the app, it's probably going to be fine. And back in the older days, you had many more issues. You know, I was working on a really large cross-platform C++ code base, lots of shared code, compiled libraries, things like that. I mean, there's, you know, lots of potential for things that are not going to work perfectly in the transition or that are going to take time to port. Now, it's not such a big deal, but it is still a deal. It is still, okay, now we have to block out some time and update our apps. And we don't know if there'll be any kind of emulation story. We don't know if we need to absolutely be there on day one, or our apps don't work on new computers, or if there's some kind of grace period, you know, in there where we can take our time upgrading. So it is disrupting, just a matter of whether it's kind of worth it in the long run.
I have a theory that pops into my mind, which I'll just get on tape here so I can either be scorned for it or celebrated down the road.
Right.
This probably isn't that celebration worthy. It's kind of obvious, but I'll just say it. I think if I go with that idea that like, okay, Apple sees kind of like several incentives here, owning your own architecture, you know, getting ARM to a pro level status, getting a new, you know, very pro-centric, dedicated Mac Pro out there, all of those things are sort of like complementary to each other, and they come together with like whatever performance you're trying to eke out of a machine. I'm sure you can eke it out better if you are in such control of the primary chips that make up the architecture for the machine, mm-hmm. that you could like, you know, you could streamline, you could make certain operations, you know, prioritize certain operations so you have custom instructions for them, whatever. If you're sitting down and you're sitting at the table at Apple and you're saying, okay, we need to make a Mac Pro, throw out all preconceptions about what Mac means and what Pro means and what is this device. And then you start getting the brainstorming. You say, well, this is, you know, we can't do this because this, we don't have a chip for this. Oh, but what if we made our own chips for that? And I think if you start going down that road, there is a reasonable kind of line of thinking that Apple is making its own custom desktop chips. They are ARM-based. They maybe are like dramatically different from iOS chips in some ways that serve, you know, Mac Pro desktop needs. And maybe they're only going to be in the Mac Pro mm-hmm. for some period of time, right? Because one of the things I think about often when I think about Apple switching to from Intel now to ARM or something, you know, a different architecture, is there's a certain class of customer that's like really dependent on and comfortable with the coincidence that the Intel architecture makes it really easy to virtualize Windows, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Now, if I had to pick one class of Apple product where virtualizing Windows doesn't matter, I might be naive here, I might be totally wrong, people can correct me, but I would guess it's the Mac Pro. Because you are running, people are using this stuff to run like high performance, very customized, specific software to do computing tasks. And when you're in that situation, I don't think that most of the people who want to spend the money to get that kind of machinery want to do that just to virtualize another operating system.
Right. I agree with you. I think there is a percentage of Mac Pro users who need to run Windows sometimes, and those people will be really disappointed. But I agree kind of with your point, though, which is most people are not like that, because if you need to run Windows mostly, you will save quite a bit of money actually getting a PC.
Just get a PC, right?
Yeah, compared to a Mac Pro. So I still have a problem with the timing of this, because let's say Bloomberg is right and 2020 is when this switch will start happening.
Yeah.
The Mac Pro comes out in 2019. It has to use Intel. Mac Pros, especially this new one, are designed to last a very long time. Like, you can imagine someone spending $5,000 or more, up to $10,000 or whatever these things are going to cost, fully configured. You can imagine they buy it in 2019 and they want to use it for 10 years.
Yeah.
If they make a switch away from an Intel 6 months later, 12 months later, it just doesn't quite feel right. And it also traps developers a little bit in that, like, we're going to be locked in to shipping for both mm-hmm. architectures for at least another 10 years. Like, there's no way they're going to be able to transition quickly away from Intel.
So my whole theory on this is completely based on the idea that Apple has no intention of this Mac Pro ever supporting Intel architecture.
Okay.
So I realize this is all a stretch, but yeah. You know, this is all based on the idea, why would it take until 2019? Oh, well, maybe if they're making their own custom chip architecture for it. And, you know, maybe Gurman got it the year wrong.
Yeah, maybe.
Or maybe this Mac Pro ships in December of 2019, mm-hmm. and it's right. effectively it's 2020.
Enough. So if you're right about this, when does Apple need to tell us? This WWDC or 2019 WWDC? Because they have to tell us at least mm-hmm. several months before the first machine ships.
I think it's 2019 WWDC mm-hmm. for a fall to winter.
Okay.
You know, later that year announcement.
So they announced.
I'm just feeling like I know all the answers. I don't know anything, of course.
Yeah. So, but I mean, it works. Well, what I like about your theory, I think you're wrong for the record, but what I like about your theory is that it lines up and makes some kind of sense, where they could announce in 1 year, they announce Mac Pro shipping in 3 months. It's amazing. also, we're moving away from Intel. This is the first one.
Yep.
Get your apps ready now. You have until the fall to get them ready for pro users. And we already have, you know, beta versions of Logic and Final Cut and all our pro apps ready to go. That mm-hmm. is consistent and works.
Yes.
But it doesn't quite, it seems aggressive. It doesn't, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It just seems, so, almost seems too early still.
Yeah, and it might be, but they have been working on this for a year now, theoretically, you know, presumably, and it's possible they were actually working on it before they came up with their, you know, announcement a year ago. But mm-hmm. I do think whatever they've been working, whatever this is, if we assume that my theory is correct and this is a new pro level Mac based on the ARM architecture. I mean, the nice thing about the Mac Pro is they can put like 100 of these things in there, right? It doesn't have to be an architecture. It doesn't have to be a chip that matches up chip to chip to Intel architecture, I don't think. And again, I'm naive about some of these things. But I can imagine if you know, in the realm of my naive thinking, I can imagine Apple saying, okay, we have a ton of space and we make our own custom designed ARM chips. And we've gotten pretty good at making custom designed ARM chips over the past several years for iOS. And of course, we've been like playing with this idea of macOS on ARM, and we've been testing it, and we've been building macOS this way. And so, you know, all this to say, like, there isn't a lot of debugging, like the kind of stuff that developers are going to have to do to port to ARM. I suspect Apple has substantially already done all of that. So I think if, you know, a Mac Pro capable ARM architecture chip fell out of the sky into Cupertino, they could probably ship a Mac with that, with Mac OS, pretty quickly. Given all of the, like, all of the advantages that they have for this theorized product, I don't think it's that aggressive. And I think that it would be, it helps me in my thinking about it, because it fills in it replaces the question mark in what the heck is the Mac Pro going to do that the iMac Pro isn't doing for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if it just blows out of the water everybody's expectations for what performance is in a way that comes with the one caveat, oh, you're going to have to recompile for ARM. That, it sort of answers Colin's question, like, what is the consumer trade-off? And it also, I don't think I got to this earlier, but the way I was thinking about this, one thing I was thinking was, you know how Apple said a few years ago, like, it made a big splash, and they said, one more thing or something, we're going to start building Macs in the United States. Right. And what it really meant was we're going to build Mac Pros in the United States. And the reason they could make that change is only because the expected, you know, build quantity of Mac Pros is small. And so I think this goes in line and works with, you know, speaking of like how aggressive is it, it works with it being a sort of a slow rollout of this idea of custom ARM chips. If they can just focus on... think about the things they don't have to worry as much about. They don't have to worry as much about power consumption, I think, because it's just going into this box that's always plugged in. They still want to worry about it, but they don't have to obsess about it like they do on an iPad or iPhone. And they can just focus on the answering the question, can we put custom ARM chips in a Mac, have macOS run on it, and let specialized software that's been recompiled for this platform completely tear up performance numbers? And I don't know. I think that might be possible, my understanding of things.
So one of the, as you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, if they only give a few months for people to get their apps ready, and this is for pro users, let's not forget about all the pro apps that... maybe the most important apps on the platform for pro users that Apple doesn't control, that also have a huge legacy code base, Photoshop, apps like that. And so I was like, it's not going to work. Like, those apps are just not going to be ready unless they have given the memo to Adobe to start working right now. Those apps are just not going to be ready. And then that would just cripple that computer who's going to buy a Mac Pro for thousands of dollars, and it's untested on a new architecture, and their apps don't work well. But then I was thinking about, you remember, I can't remember which Mac this was. This is the old Mac days, classic Mac days. They sold a Mac that you could put like a 386 card in.
Yes, yeah.
I can't remember what it was called. You know, it was like a 486 or something. You could have both architectures. They could do that with the Mac Pro, where for so many thousands of dollars, hey, guess what? It has some Intel processors.
Has an Intel in it too. It doesn't even need to be a card, right?
It's just there. Maybe it's not the base model, or maybe it is. Who knows? But it's got both. It's got brand new. It's got the future of what we want to do. But you know, we threw in a few Intel chips too, so that Photoshop still runs great. And you know, I don't know. We work some magic somehow. I don't know how that would actually work exactly. But they could do something like that, because these computers are going to be so expensive. Yeah. Why not just have the best of both worlds for pro users? All right, we're happy to have Text Expander for Teams from Smile sponsoring the podcast again. Text Expander multiplies your team's productivity by making up-to-date, shared knowledge available instantly to everyone who needs it. Using Text Expander, all of your team's common responses are accessible and searchable through simple abbreviations and keyboard shortcuts, written and edited by your best writers, available on multiple platforms, macOS, iOS, Windows, and the web, updated immediately everywhere when they're modified. If you're on a support or sales team, or if you're in legal, medical, or real estate, Text Expander will change your life, leaving you more time to focus on what you do best. Visit textexpander.com/podcast for 20% off your first year.
Now, Manton, you know I use Text Expander all the time with my team of one. So I can't really speak from personal experience about the brilliance of Text Expander for Teams, but it seems obvious to me that it would be such a benefit, especially when you're trying to standardize the ways in which you respond to customers. You want to have, you know, if you're a big enough team, you want to have like multiple support representatives, for instance, who are responding to people. And when they give an answer to something, have it be the definitive answer. Don't have it be like the best thing that that particular individual, as smart as they may be, can think of on that day. Get your answers down pat and share them across your team. So the Teams aspect of Text Expander, while I don't use it per se, I can really appreciate it. And that goes really in line with another feature of Text Expander, which while I don't use it, I can appreciate it, which is Windows support. I mean, I look at this, I think, oh yeah, Windows support. That is something that would be handy if you work on a team that's not completely consistently based on one platform. So I think that their thoughtfulness about this, about what do people really need when they're trying to be more productive, trying to be consistent, trying to have powerful, expressive, communicative language available to all the members of a team, whether they're on the Mac, iOS, Windows, or the web. Share all your snippets with everybody on your team. Believe me, the productivity gains and the customer impact payback on this is going to be well worth it. So do yourself a favor. Get yourself, get your boss, get whoever's in charge of setting up your team's infrastructural software. Get them to go to textexpander.com/podcast and make sure you select Core Intuition from the Where You Heard About Us, and you'll get 20% off your first year. Thanks so much to Text Expander for Teams for sponsoring the show. Before the break, I was sort of biting my lip because I wanted to jump in and say that I totally get where you're going with this idea that maybe Apple needs to have, for instance, Adobe, you know, other big performance folks on board if they're going to come out with this new architecture. But then the thought that came into my mind was, they're just so perfectly situated with this device to not please everybody. The iMac Pro, as you know, everybody's noticed or noted that has been like, from everything I've read, it's been extremely successful. And people who need a quote unquote Mac Pro, you know, the Mac Pro in quotes, so many people have been satisfied with the iMac Pro that it seems like many of them will never even need to get whatever the Mac Pro turns out to be. I think this is like Apple is set up for the Mac Pro 2019, whatever it turns out to be, for it to be almost like the concept car. Like, prove what this company's technology can do. And if you have to jump through the, you know, the sunroof to get into this car, it's okay. Because the things that this computer does, it only has to... It's a very interesting thing because Apple doesn't need to make a lot of these for like its bottom line, right? This is about pleasing a market segment and about sort of like establishing Apple as an industry leader in a realm that matters perhaps more for reputation than for like totally pragmatic customer base. Mm-hmm. So like, I think really, you know, and I think about it, you know, a year from now, a year and a half, let's say, when this thing comes out, most likely, there'll probably be a new iMac Pro as well. There'll probably be something a lot more powerful than what the iMac Pro is people have now. There'll be something for people who want to run Adobe Photoshop really fast. There'll be something for people who want to run Adobe Premiere really fast. And I don't know if Apple cares that much if some customers are disappointed that the Mac Pro 2019 can only run what's Apple's thing? The Final Cut. Yeah, can only run Final Cut really fast. In fact, if that happened, it might be a little bit fishy because it would be a kind of unfair advantage. But I mean, it wouldn't be if Apple gave Adobe the opportunity to port to that platform. And I don't think it's that big of a, you know, I also envision this pro market as being very, like having a very narrow scope of software needs. Like I see them needing like maybe like five apps, right? You know, it's not like they need the typical consumer. If you, a consumer computer needs to address like the massive landscape of all like general purpose software. That's why it was a big deal, like making the transitions from 68K to PowerPC and then to Intel. And, you know, similarly from 32-bit to 64-bit. But I don't know. I guess I just, through my rose colored glasses, I can see the Mac Pro 2019 existing in a world where there's already a super powerful iMac Pro. And where there's already pretty powerful MacBook Pros, where they just say, hey, this is not for everybody. And in fact, you know, they're probably, maybe they'll be making this thing in Austin like they did the last one.
Actually, I think it was near Fort Worth, but
close enough. Dang it. Anyway, but then maybe they'll be making this in Texas. And like I said, they don't need the money. They don't need to make that many of these. And if they sell these to just the people who have been begging them, like, hey, we are super powerful power users who make art with Macs, and why don't you throw us a bone and make the best dang Mac ever for Final Cut, for Logic, for all these things, even if they were all just Apple stuff.
Yeah, but there's not enough of Apple stuff. So, you know, we think about, so what are the main pro apps from Apple? Logic and Final Cut are the big ones. They also have Motion, which is a fantastic app. So on the, like, let's say on the Adobe side, you have, instead of Final Cut, you have Premiere. I know a lot of YouTube folks use Premiere for some reason. They're used to it. They like the, you know, timeline editor better or whatever. And Logic, you know, you have like Adobe Audition and other apps like that. You have Adobe After Effects, so you don't need Motion. So they have complements, but then there's a whole class of apps that Apple has nothing for. 3D modeling apps, nothing. Mm-hmm. Photoshop, Illustrator, nothing. So I don't think this could work. I mean, I think that you would have to have at least the top couple of these pro apps on this computer. Otherwise, it would be not a pro computer because it would be like the Final Cut workstation. It wouldn't be for enough people.
I think you're really onto something with the 3D modeling apps. I don't think it matters maybe that much whether Photoshop in particular is on this computer, because I think Photoshop is a kind of pro app that gets as much power as it typically needs from an iMac Pro. I might be wrong about that, but I think of the Mac Pro as the tool that people need when they're doing tons of video transcoding.
Right, right.
And they're doing lots of, and I think the 3D modeling is a great example of that.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is, Apple doesn't strictly need a video editing app for this because they have Final Cut. I think you're right that they do need a 3D modeling solution.
But they can't build...
No, I'm not saying they should build one.
Apps.
No, okay. I'm not suggesting they should. I was going down the path of thinking that they could incentivize somebody else to port.
Right.
Like, it's not... I think Adobe is game for porting in general, but in the past, there have been some, like, resistance. There has been resistance in the past to Adobe and other companies meeting Apple's preferred timeline.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going down the path of thinking like, okay, well, if Apple comes out with this, maybe they just need to have like one standout app for every
mm-hmm.
kind of like
category
segment.
Yeah.
But that's flawed too, because the truth is pros want to use the yeah. one app that they use.
Right. They're not going to switch. If they've been using for 15 years,
yeah.
some 3D modeling app, rendering app, they're not going to switch. It's impossible.
Yeah.
Like they've got their workflow. Yeah. When you think about like this Mac Pro, I mean, performance is one thing. That's mostly what we're talking about. And you can imagine, you know, if they put a ton of these custom chips in here and you could have some like really parallel workflows, like that's great. But equally to performance, I think, is the expandability. I mean, we're kind of assuming that you're going to be able to expand this thing with like maybe it's kind of hard to imagine Apple doing like a big tower, but maybe they do something where you can actually put a bunch of drives in it like the old days.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It seems unlikely because that's like the opposite of their story with the current Mac Pro. But anyway, expandability and like, yeah, what kind of apps need like terabytes and terabytes of disk space?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's these 3D apps that render super high resolution, you know, movies. It's like the Final Cut stuff, which is just enormous files when you're doing video editing. So, I mean, I feel like it would not be a complete story for pros if most or all apps that they use today worked. It just seems too much to ask people to move to.
I hear you. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think you're right about that. I think that doesn't rule out my whole pipe dream here, but it does mean that I think Apple would have to start working behind the scenes mm-hmm. with key players to make it. So, you know, you get to a point where it's like, you get enough of the key players ported over, you know, that's why they always have these keynotes. It's like part of the pitch is like, and we've got, you know, Avid out here with,
mm-hmm.
they've already ported, and, you know, then that like puts everybody else on high alert that they better port or be left behind.
And it will be easier, I think, this time. Because when you think about the tricky Adobe transition in particular, well, they had a couple things they had to go through. One, they had to go from Carbon to Cocoa.
Yeah.
And that was an extremely painful transition. And then, of course, they had to go, you know, to 64-bit. Then they, you know, they had to go to Intel. Saying this out of order, but like they had a couple really tricky transitions on really old code base. And I think it would be much, much easier this time for them. Like, I don't think they need a 2-year head start.
I think it should be. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to talk to you about, it actually goes kind of in line with this, is, you know, another thing that Matthew Panzerino revealed in this TechCrunch article was the fact, this was, in my opinion, this was kind of the more interesting news, because the Mac Pro news was really just putting a year on it, putting a commitment on it. It didn't say like anything new about what it's going to do. It didn't say it's going to be ARM, it's going to be, mm-hmm. you know, multiprocessor, rack mounted, whatever. But the Apple shared with Matthew Panzerino something called, what is it? The Pro Workflow Team. And if you just put those words out and ask me what that meant, I would guess it meant, oh, Apple has a group that's studying what pros need to do when they're working. And it's sort of the case, but the way Apple's apparently approaching this is, I think, pretty novel. The way Matthew Panzerino relays it, Apple has effectively hired like crew of real what do you call them? Like real creative professionals who work on things like audio editing and video editing and, you know, producing movies for video, you know, for like music videos and movies and all this jazz, maybe even jazz specifically. but the thing, here's the key, according to the way he describes it, it's like they're set up almost like as a test bed of like pros at work. Like they're doing real work like next door to the people who make Apple's pro apps. And it's kind of like, it would be like me hiring a bunch of bloggers
to work in
my attic.
I'd love to do that.
Just so you know, Daring Fireball is now a subsidiary of Red Sweater because I need to just be able to lean over and say, hey, John, what do you think? Tags or no tags?
That would be fantastic. Yeah, this I'm kind of imagining this is like the Apple Park or Infinite Loop like co-working facility. It's like you have some, you know, it says like there's full-time and part-time people. Like, this is really confusing. I don't know what this is, but I'm kind of imagining it like a co-working thing. It's like, yeah, come on down. We've got an office for you, or we've got the shared area, and you have, you know, the best Mac Pro and iMac Pro money can buy waiting for you at your desk and do some work. And every once in a while, we'll bug you about a beta version of Logic and see if you like it or not.
And then there are so many more questions raised by this recording. no offense to Matthew Panzerino, but I mean, just because of the subject at hand, because it's like, I'm immediately wondering like, okay, they're hired by Apple or, and work for Apple, or are they contractors for Apple, but are they doing work for Apple? It's not clear.
Not at all. It kind of sounds like they're doing their own thing.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like they're getting paid to run a consulting business from within.
Pretty great.
Apple Park.
I want this job. I would love to work at Apple Park and do my own business.
Right. Do you want to understand the independent Mac and iOS developer? Just hire us to work on our indie apps at Apple Park.
That'd be great.
That'd be amazing. Okay. We really don't know. Like, and the fact that some of them are on a contract basis suggests that like they've just paid them to like come work at Apple for, I don't know, a few months while they study how they work on stuff.
I don't understand this at all.
It's like, was this April Fool's Day that this happened?
And to be fair, I haven't read every word of this article. I skimmed through it and read parts of it, and like I missed a detail in there that explains everything, but it's not clear what they're doing and what they're getting paid for. So it's fascinating. It's fascinating. It reminds me a little like when you talk about like maybe these people they come in, they work on their own projects, or they're like, it talks in the article about shooting video and stuff like that. It reminds me a little of what YouTube actually does, I believe, for like this really high profile vloggers. Like, I think they can go to certain offices in different cities, and there's like YouTube has like a studio that they can use, like if they want to record something. And I don't know if it's free, probably it's just free. They probably don't get paid to be there, but it's like a way to support some of the biggest, you know, people on the platform. It feels kind of like that almost. It's like, we've got this facility that you can come work, and maybe we've got some equipment that you can use because we want to support the creative community.
That's interesting, especially since you mentioned YouTube being a Google company. It brings back to mind, you know, we talked last week about Apple's really challenge. I mean, it's an uphill battle to try to take back Google's progress that they've made with Chromebooks in the classroom. I got started thinking, especially in the context of this news that Apple is like deeply studying pro app users, like in their little internal work lab. And it kind of reminded me of the Apple Education event. And especially, you know, I recently listened to the talk show episode with Serenity Caldwell about their experience there. Mm-hmm. And it really struck me like, oh, this is the same kind of thing. Like they didn't mention it in this interview with Matthew Panzerino, but it sounds like they have very similar things going on with educators and with the teaching experience. And, you know, I don't know if they've hired teachers. I'm sure there's some pretty stoked teachers if they went from being paid teacher salaries to getting paid by Apple to go work in Cupertino. But, you know, the point being, this is something I hadn't considered, which is the idea that Apple's advantage in education or in pro software could be more about the human aspect of understanding the customers than about specific technical advantages.
Right. I found that part in the article that I was thinking about where he says, Matthew writes, these are award-winning artists and technicians that are brought in to shoot real projects. I saw a bunch of them walking by in Apple Park toting kit for an outdoor shoot on premises while walking. So very interesting. And of course, it's a beautiful campus and like who wouldn't want to shoot something there? An interview or something.
But yeah, but it better not be like the new Wrigley's commercial or something, because it doesn't make sense for that to be filmed on Apple campus. Yeah. It really, again, like I said, there's so many questions. It makes me wonder, first of all, you could imagine a bunch of these people being hired, and sure, they've worked on music videos and stuff before, but maybe now they're working on ads for Apple or something. Hmm. Maybe they're working on the WWDC promo videos, right? But then there's also this other big question mark, which is nobody really knows. You know, Apple announced a while back, didn't they say something like $1 billion or something for Apple TV production? I don't know. I forget the figure, but right. it was a number that seemed big for normal people and small for Apple. Mm-hmm. So I think it might have been a billion. And so we don't know how many. If that's true, then Apple has legitimate needs to hire world-class video and audio production people just to work on stuff like that. I mean, I know usually like companies like Netflix, they don't literally have the filmmakers in Netflix's building, but it's more of a licensing thing, I think. But it depends on how Apple chooses to attack this. If maybe they are making, what was that show I never watched that you
Planet
indulged?
Of the Apps.
Planet of the Apps. Maybe they're making Planet of the Apps 2 in the outdoor space of Apple Park.
This is interesting. I'd love to hear more about this. I hope they share more about it. And we'll see.
Yep.
I love the idea of supporting artists. So I think however they're doing it, sounds like it's probably a good thing. And you and I just need to get to work on hiring bloggers and then everything will be good.
Or getting hired by Apple to do our job on Xcode and then yelling down the hall, hey, this thing's crashing again. Somebody get in here. Hey, this playground is bogus.
I'm like, Daniel, I know you've only been here a day, but we're going to need to retract the contract we gave you because we're sick of you bothering us.
You sound like the Office Space guy. I'm going to have to ask you to come in on Saturday. All right, our second sponsor today, our old friends at Linode. Of course, you've heard us talking about Linode, and yet I suspect some of you still have not taken advantage of Linode's great services. So I'm talking to you. If you need a Linux box to host a website, a private Git repository, or maybe to serve as the backend for your iOS app, I want you to consider Linode Cloud Hosting. With Linode, you can get a server running in under a minute. They've been doing infrastructure as a service since 2003. And their plans start at the 1 gigabyte level for only $5 a month. Linode has 10 global data centers equipped with industry-leading data center-grade SSDs, and their plans range from that low $5 a month plan up to higher memory plans that start at 16 gigabytes. All of those plans come with the full control you expect with a VM. They support Docker containers, encrypted disks, VPNs, etc. Now, you get all this control, you get it at a great price, and of course, it all comes with Linode's 24/7 friendly support. They're even open on holidays. I also have a $20 credit that you can get if you use the coupon code CoreInt2018. And the easiest way to use that promo code, just remember this, linode.com/CoreInt. That will redirect you to a page that has the CoreInt2018 promo code ready to go. Use that promo code, and it's effectively like getting 4 free months at the entry-level $5 a month plan. So thanks so much to Linode for sponsoring the show yet again.
So I have a bunch of Linode instances now for running Micro.blog, and we are about to launch something new on Micro.blog, something I'm really excited about, we've been working on. I think it's going to be really great. Can't share it as we record now, but next week maybe be able to talk about it. So if you're listening to the episode a little late, maybe check out my blog or micro.blog. But the point is, every once in a while, I need to add a new server or upgrade one. And there's one server in particular I have that I want to upgrade before this launch. So how does that work with Linode? It's super easy. You go into the Linode dashboard where they have all the features that you can click around on to manage your instances. Click the resize tab, and then you can just pick another plan. Like if you had started at the $5 a month level and decided you need a bigger disk and more memory and that sort of thing, you can just click on a different one, hit resize, it puts it into a queue to update, restart, and then you're good to go. It's very well automated, and it's really easy to go through and do this. So I plan on doing this over the weekend, actually, to one of my instances. And you know, you can spin up a new instance and move things over as you want, but sometimes it's easier just to upgrade what you have. So Linode makes this really easy to go up or down in your plan. Everything's prorated, so you're not overcharged. Great service. Thanks to Linode for sponsoring the show. Go to linode.com/corent.
So Manton, I spoke with you months ago, I think now. I think this has been an ongoing saga, sort of. It's a lot of saga for a little thing, but, you know, I got one of these MacBook Pro late 2016 editions. I was one of the dummies who bought it in May of 2017. And then, like, I think Apple announced the new MacBook Pros, like, the slight updates in, like, 3 weeks later or something. And I probably could have, like, fought for, I don't know, an exception to the 2 week rule, but I was like, okay, well, I guess I'm stuck with what I'm stuck with. And anyway, it was all fine, you know, apart from the usual complaints about little things that aren't as good as I think they should be with the new MacBook Pros. I was kind of willing to just accept the way things were. Occasionally I hit the stupid, you know, Siri button on the touch bar and I just cancel it. Occasionally I, you know, expect the escape key to be there and it's not there. For whatever reason, I never had the same degree of problem some people have with, like, the keys just stopping to work. By the time I got to the Apple store, I kind of wished I had, because the problem I did have, which was that one of the keys, the command key, like, just wore away really quickly. That wasn't deemed by the Apple store as repair worthy. And I was like, dang it, like, this thing's under warranty and this is wearing away like a piece of crap. And if I had just, like, eaten a sandwich over this thing more often and gotten a crumb in there, then they'd be sending it away for a complete replacement. But no, I don't, you know, I just thought, well, this is really ridiculous. And I kind of, like, got depressed about it. And I had switched over back to my 2014 MacBook Pro. Because I always do this when I take something in for repair. I was so confident Apple was going to repair this. I switched everything over to my MacBook Pro from 2014. I was running my life on it. Brought this into the Apple store. They rejected me. And then I was just like, well, what do I do now? And I ended up actually, like, even trying to email Tim Cook. I was like, I'm going to go full drama king on this. No crickets, no response from Tim Cook. Okay, so that didn't work. And then I finally just got back on the line with Apple support. And I said, can I just take a picture of this and get a second opinion? And they were like, I am not authorized to give second opinions, or something like that. And then they said, but you can take it into an Apple store where a certified Apple blah, blah, blah can take a look at it. And I was like, is there any way I can just not go into an Apple store again? Because, like, my spirit is crushed. The last time I went in, I was pretty honest with them about it. I was just like, you know, last time I went in, I spent like a couple hours out of my day to go, you know, back up my whole computer, go into the Apple store, have them tell me it was cosmetic and they're not going to repair it. And I really don't want to have to do that again. So what ended up happening, to my delight, woman on the chat said, well, what we can do is we can send you a box and you can, like, ship it to our repair depot. And if they don't think it's covered under warranty, they'll give you a quote. And I was like, okay, well, you know what? It's weirdly enough, like, shipping something is easier than going into the Apple store. And I already had my whole life transferred over to my old MacBook Pro and was frankly doing pretty well on it.
Yeah.
So I say, fine, I'm going to do this. So they shipped me the box. I was all ready to go. I always do this when I ship anything to Apple. I erase everything on it, back up everything to something else, erase everything. I make an admin user account called username Apple, password Apple. Makes it so easy for them. And then I know I don't have any of my junk on there. I don't have to give them any of my passwords. Ship it off to them. And, you know, to Apple's credit, they're always so fast, I think, with these repairs and returns. A couple days later, they're like, yep, we fixed everything wrong with your MacBook and it's coming back.
Nice.
And I was like, okay, that's cool. Like, it sounds like they fixed the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Either that, or I didn't know, and I didn't know what to expect until I opened the box, because like, it could just mean there was nothing wrong with your MacBook, so we fixed everything and sent it back. But they kind of said like, everything's okay, MacBook's coming back. And so then I got the box, and I was, as always, I was like a little tentative opening it up, because I don't want to be like disappointed. I'm going to open this up, and there's going to be like a, not only is my key going to be worn out, but there's going to be like a big, you know, F you for sending this in.
They just fixed your key with like a piece of tape or something.
Right, yeah. Happy
fixed
now?
Fixed it. Nailed it.
Nailed it. Anyway, this is a long rambling story.
Yeah, it is. Get to the point. What's happening?
This is a long monologue about, this is a one-man play, one-act, one-man play, repairing my MacBook Pro. I opened it up. First thing I see, of course, is the little sheet that says like what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I just open that. Before I even open up the MacBook, I look at the sheet. I'm expecting it to say whether or not they replaced my key, or, you know, knowing what I know, whether they probably replaced the whole keyboard. And sure enough, they replaced the whole top case,
because mm-hmm.
that's what they have to do when they want to replace one keycap these days. Oh, and I kind of feel weird about that, because it seems such a dramatic thing to have to do, to replace one keycap. But I also want my expensive MacBook to look as it should mm-hmm. 11 months after I bought it.
Sure.
Here's the kicker, though. There's another repair listed. Replace the motherboard.
Whoa.
Replace the logic board.
What? Which I assume you thought was working just fine.
I thought it was working just fine, although, you know, it's funny. I've reported a few bugs to Apple over the past year that, you know, I have a friend that works in at Apple, who was, some of the bugs I reported were pertinent to his group. And at one point he was just like, are you sure you don't have bad RAM or something? And I was like, no, I don't have bad RAM. Are you kidding me? I'd know if I had bad RAM. And then what does this thing say? It says, logic board replaced. Oh, here, I have it right here. It says, here's what we did. We replaced the parts below. Logic board. Symptom, memory errors / not recognized. Whatever that means. So,
wow.
I ended up being rejected for a wearing away command key on a less than year old MacBook Pro. And my persistence in getting that command key replaced was rewarded with discovering that I had a bad motherboard.
Yeah. Wow.
And so I feel real good about that.
This is great. And they did it all for free.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
All for free. So this like stubborn refusal to address my under warranty, what they called cosmetic problem, ultimately they ended up thinking, hey, not only should we replace this keyboard, but this is what I love about Apple at its best. I don't think every company in the tech industry, when you sent something in for a bad key,
mm-hmm.
would end up finding out that the logic board had memory problems.
Right.
And they have a system, you know, it's kind of frustrating. If you ever take anything into the Apple store for like a repair, sometimes they're like, okay, well, we're just going to sit here for about 15 minutes while we run every test known to man. And you're like, can you just do the thing that fixes my thing? But sometimes they find something like this. Now, of course, they didn't run any tests when I took it into the Apple store. I have a little bit of a grudge now against the Apple store, which shall not be named in my local area.
Well, it confirms kind of my comment when we first talked about this, which is that 9 times out of 10, you get some at the Apple store. They're friendly. They know what they're talking about. They're great.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, you get that one guy who thinks he knows more than anybody and is wrong. And that's what you got. I mean, I really think you mm-hmm. just got a really like
bad genius.
Yeah, I mean, just someone who just didn't make the right call. And I know sometimes it's difficult and they have the rules to follow, but ultimately it has proven that that was a waste of time for you and for the people that helped you at that Apple store, because you ended up sending it in and they fixed everything. And yeah, that happens sometimes. I mean, Apple can't make the right mm-hmm. decision every time. Like I said, 9 times out of 10, I think they do the right thing, but every once in a while you get someone and they make the wrong call. So I'm really glad this worked out. It's also funny that they did way more than you asked them to do, because that actually happened with my MacBook Pro. I brought it in for what? I can't remember now. I brought it in for something.
Mm-hmm.
And they fixed the thing. I came back in a few days. They fixed the thing, and they also replaced the whole screen, like the whole top.
Oh, it was the screen delamination problem.
Which I had no idea was a problem.
Yes.
But
I had the same thing with my with this MacBook Pro I'm using now, this 2014. It was the same kind of thing where I guess, you know, for all the complaining I do about Apple support, I've had some really, really lucky slash great repairs.
Mm-hmm.
And this was one of those things, yeah, where it was like, they noticed it while they were repairing something else. And it's like one of those things where it's like internally, it's not like they've put out an all points bulletin saying like, hey, if you have screen delamination, we know that's a problem. Come bring it in and we'll fix it.
Right.
It's just that when they see that, they're like, yeah, well, while we're fixing this, we're going to fix that too.
Makes sense. I say this every time and it makes you feel good.
Yeah.
The funny thing about that particular trip for me is they gave the computer back to me. Like, oh, we fixed this and this. I'm like, oh, great. And I looked at it. I'm like, where are my stickers?
Right. You weren't expecting that.
I had stickers on the back. And mm-hmm. I was, you know, we laughed about it. It's not the end of the world because just there was a few stickers. But it's just funny that, like, those stickers, they had to replace it. So those stickers are gone in the trash can somewhere recycled. I don't know. But it was amusing to me because I was not expecting to get my computer back without the stickers. And without the same parts that I gave it to them with.
So we should wrap up, Manton, but I want to say real quickly, I'm still on. So the funny thing is I got my new fancy MacBook Pro back, and I've been putting off doing that arduous process. You know, it's the transfer process. It's just not as smooth as it should be,
right.
And it's worse in my case because at least on the way over to this Mac, the migration assistant did not work. So I had to do like a kind of weird, like, you know, clone to a disk and then clone to a disk back. And that's the kind of stuff it takes hours and hours out of your day. And when you want to just be working on your app, it's not your priority. But now I have this situation where I've been fairly happy and gotten used to my 2014 MacBook Pro, and it drives home just how little difference there is in at least the feeling of performance for everyday stuff.
You need to sell the new computer.
That's what I've thought of doing.
Now that it's in perfect condition.
I know. But the thing is, I sort of need a computer for my kids. And I've been sort of, the idea has been that this is their computer that I'm borrowing back now.
Yeah.
But I'm tempted to just buy them some cheap, you know, cheaper computer and just keep using this. But I don't know. I have to say, in all honesty, even though I really love the old keyboard and I've been preferring typing on it, some things have been bugging me. The MagSafe, which I love, is on the wrong side for the side of the couch that I like to sit on, you know? So I'm always like knocking it off and getting annoyed. And I'm thinking like, if I only had that USB-C connector, it'd be golden right now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a little heavier. The heaviness adds up.
Mm-hmm.
The screen's not as nice. That is noticeable. I don't care, it turns out, about not having the touch bar, in part because I only ever hit it by accident, and I guess in part because I've never really found a good use for it. But there are, just to say, in all fairness, there are a lot of nice things about the new MacBook Pro. So I think I'm going to switch back to it.
Okay.
And I kind of feel like I kind of owe it to it now.
Yeah. That makes sense. I mean, you bought the computer for a reason. I mean, you might as well use it. You didn't know it was quite as fragile as it seems to be when you bought it. But
the complication here is the reason I bought it was because now I'm remembering there was logic board issues, I think, with my old one.
Oh, funny.
That I was sending it in for when I got that free delamination fix. And I bought the new one in a kind of like frenzy, like, dang it, I don't want to stop working right now. I need a new computer. And so I guess I'll just get a new computer and then figure it out. And then that was it. And then I was on the new computer and the old one came back pristine. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just give this to the kids now.
Well,
anyway, this is a pretty luxurious set of problems I have here, especially you know, given that Apple keeps repairing these things for free when I give them enough pressure.
I'm glad it has a happy ending and you get to make the choice without having to give Apple $500 or more. To close this out, I want to point out a video that Stephen Hackett made yesterday. And, you know, the new MacBook Pro, there's trade-offs. We all know. A little bit better, a little bit worse.
Yep.
We all kind of acknowledge that now. And he had a video called Three Reasons to Buy the 2015 MacBook Pro. and then in the actual video thumbnail says, buy the 2015 MacBook Pro instead. And I think his arguments are pretty sound. But yeah, like it's a trade-off. But the fact that so many people say, you know what, just buy the old one.
Yeah.
It's, you'll save some money and it's just as good and better in some ways. Maybe it'll last longer. It's fascinating. And I think Apple, they have to address this at some point. Maybe when they get done with the Mac Pro, they'll work on the MacBook Pro again.
Yep. Well, I know I said one last thing before. Final last thing. I will say in my initial tests, it does seem like the replacement keyboard is slightly less loud and clicky clacky than the first gen one that I seemed to have. So there's progress.
That's good. That's all we can ask. All right. Good talking to you this week, Daniel. Thanks everyone for listening. Thanks for the kind of questions and comments about what to talk about this week. I didn't point them all out when we were talking about the Mac Pro and Intel, but in the Slack, you can find more of that stuff. If you want to join the community and you haven't yet, go to chat.corent.org. And of course, if you have other feedback and you want to send via email, feedback@corent.org or on Twitter or on micro.blog @corent.